Well, oftentimes when I'm reading through the Bible, I come across a passage or a section, and I think, what really is the point? And that's not to say that I don't understand the scriptures that I'm reading. A lot of the times I do, and I can certainly comprehend the words that are there. But rather, oftentimes, I'll feel like that there's simply more to the story than simply just what those words are that are written down. And in those instances, I try hard to kind of pull back a little bit and recognize if there is an underlying principle that God is trying to teach us. And we are so limited in our understanding of all the amazing thoughts and ideas of God that he often has to break them down into more digestible chunks. And this is especially true with spiritual concepts and spiritual principles. And God knows that if we are to grow in any of those things, then we need to internalize them through our own life experiences. We have to be able to connect with them in some way. And the core reason that God gives us so many physical actions is for this reason. Physical actions, physical constructs, because it's through the things that we can touch and feel and experience that we can grow to understand the things we cannot. A classic example of this is clean and unclean meats. There is very much a physical construct to this. It involves putting things into our mouths. But as we dive into that physical construct, we start to understand what the spiritual principle is all about. For example, it's not that some animals are bad in some way. We know that after God finished his creation, he said all his creatures were good. But by the understanding of how God has carved off a section of the food chain and separated them for a different purpose, well, then we can take that and apply that in a spiritual way and understand how he has carved off a group of called out people for a special purpose. So every time we go grocery shopping or we prepare a meal, we have this physical law that reinforces a spiritual principle that might otherwise be a little bit abstract. And as a result, so many of these physical laws and rules and regulations are the same way. They have a practical application, that's for sure, but most importantly, they try to drive at a spiritual principle. The physical, as we well know, is going to go away. The spiritual is for all eternity. So it sure is easier to understand a unique, unified relationship with God in which we fully join ourselves to him. That's a huge spiritual topic. If we have a physical construct that we can lean into, a marriage, two people coming together as one, that helps us connect those dots in a way that is much more relatable. So sometimes when I come across different parts of the Bible, I have that tendency to pull back and I think, what is the point behind this physical thing? And how is it going to connect with a spiritual principle that is timeless for all eternity? And one of those sections of scripture is found right off the bat in Genesis 1 and 2. Now you might be thinking, man, Mike, you didn't get too far into the book before you ran into all sorts of questions. But these chapters of the Bible have been hotly debated for as long as they've been written down. There is something, though, in these verses and in the creation account that always made me pause and just consider what is beyond the surface here. So let's jump in, shall we? Let's go right into Genesis 1, and we'll start in verse 2. It says, "The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters." Verse 3. "And then God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw the light, and it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness." And here we have the start of God working on organizing the world. We can see that at a high level, God is establishing order from chaos here. He's assigning roles and functions to the various elements. And further on, we see that not only does God divide light, but he also divides the waters, and he also defines their functions that they serve. And this continues on throughout chapter 1. Each day, God is working on specific elements. On the fifth day, down in verse 20, we see sea creatures and flying creatures. On the sixth day, starting in verse 24, we have land animals, including our most favorite of the land animals, human beings. It's a lot of work, a culmination of planning and organizing that stretched back, well, I mean, who knows how long? Verse 31, and God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. So the evening and the morning were the sixth day. So there's a lot happening in those 6 days, that's for sure. And this is where it gets most interesting to me, at least for the purpose of this message today. Next chapter, chapter 2, verse 1, it says, thus the heavens and the earth and all the host of them were finished. Verse 2, and on the seventh day, God ended his work, which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work, which he had done. And then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work, which God had created and made. All right, now for sure, we understand that one of the points here that these scriptures draw out is that God is giving us an example and a template of the seventh-day Sabbath. But even then, there's already some questions about that. Why did God need to give us that example? I mean, he doesn't do this with other physical constructs. He doesn't come down and eat a cow with Adam to show him clean and unclean meats. He didn't do that with other principles. And then what does it even mean that God rested? How does a deity rest? How can a being that can never tire rest? And then notice this back in Isaiah 40, if you want to flip back there. Isaiah 40, we'll go to verses 28 and 31. Isaiah 40, verses 28 and 31. Verse 28 says, have you not known? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, neither faints nor is weary. His understanding is unsearchable. And here's some of the things he does continually. He gives power to the weak, and to those who have no might, he increases strength. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall, but those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with eagles, with wings rather, like eagles, and they shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. So these are just a few of the actions that God is performing continually and constantly as part of his work. Did God not do those things so that he could rest and abstain from his work? In other words, in thinking about God resting, what really is the point? And can we draw out some principles in those scriptures that go beyond the physical? Is it just that us human beings don't clock into work on Saturday? We sleep in a little bit longer? Maybe we work extra hard and not getting our heart rate up throughout the day? Is that the point? Or is there something in this concept of rest that is woven throughout the Bible that can be applied to our spiritual lives as well? A principle that will far outlast anything physical. Well, before we jump in too deep, let's first get our bearings on the word translated rest in our Bibles. It's an extremely common word used throughout the Bible. Just the word translated rest is used in hundreds of scriptures. And that's not counting any of the underlying Greek or Hebrew words that are translated differently. It's not counting any of the many different variants. Just that word rest is the 272nd most commonly used word in the Bible, which is a pretty crazy stat that we are all going to instantly forget. There are plenty of times in the Bible, though, that the word rest means exactly what you would think. And an example of that would be to let your oxen rest. That means you're not going to try to farm with it. You're going to let it wander around, eating grass, going in the water, going in the shade. Whatever that oxen wants to do, that's what he gets to do. He's resting. And there are other passages where someone is very physically tired, and then they rest. These are obvious applications of that word. It's also a euphemism for someone dying. For example, there's plenty of scriptures where it says this king or that king died and rested with his fathers. I guess that's the kind of the ultimate. If we're thinking about just decreasing physical activity, that's zero physical activity in those cases. But the rest concept, though, continues to expand just a little bit more and in some interesting ways. Let's go to Leviticus chapter 25. Leviticus chapter 25. We'll pick it up in verse 3 of Leviticus chapter 25. It says, 6 years you shall sow your field, this is verse 3, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather its fruit. So you're using it as designed. In other words, we would say that you are working the land. Verse 4. But in the seventh year there shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall neither sow your field nor prune your vineyard. What grows of its own accord of the harvest you shall not reap, nor gather the grapes of your untended vine. For it is the year of rest for the land. So now we have this concept of rest being applied to land. The land itself must have rest. And this is so important that just one chapter later, this is one of the key warnings that God gave to the nation. And he said that if you turn your back on him, if you decide to go your own way, contrary to his laws, then in Leviticus chapter 26, verse 27 and 28, it says, then God's going to go contrary to you. And God's going to bring in all sorts of disasters and consequences. And what do you think that might include? Leviticus 26, starting in verse 32. I will bring the land to desolation, and your enemies who dwell in it shall be astonished at it. And I will scatter you among the nations and draw out sword after you. Your land shall be desolate and your cities waste. Get this, verse 34 then. Then the land shall enjoy its Sabbaths as long as it lies desolate and you are in your enemy's land. Then the land shall rest and enjoy its Sabbaths. The land must rest. And if you turn away from God, he says that he will ensure that that happens, whether you're there to see it or not. We have all these examples of rest in these various forms, but there doesn't quite seem to be a unifying thread between them. The definition of what we think of when we think of rest, at least in my mind, starts to get a little bit stretched. Because once the Israelites are taken out of Egypt as slaves, and a course is plotted for them towards the promised land, then God promises that once they arrive and once they enter, they will experience rest. And, you know, what a fantastic promise that must have been to those Israelites that were in slavery, harsh physical labor. The thought of rest, even at a physical level, should have been very tantalizing to them. But was that the reality? Now, we know the story of the Israelites and how they rebelled and how the vast majority of the original people that left Egypt, they did not get to enter the promised land, not even Moses. But let's fantasize just for a second and pretend that they didn't rebel. Let's say that they kind of got their act together. They really rallied. They hold it together from start to finish. They end their bickering ways and they get on board with what God was doing. And then they get to the Jordan River, and they start to cross over. In that case, then would they experience rest? Well, no. I mean, not really, not at first, especially if you're thinking about decreasing physical activity. Once they cross over, their physical activity is going to be ramped way up. I mean, they have to go to war. They have to clear out strongholds. They have to tear down fortresses. They have to fight armies. And then they have to build their houses. They have to plant their farms. None of that sounds all that restful to me. And maybe after a generation or two, after their enemies are vanquished and the laundry list of tasks that they needed to do just to live have been completed, then maybe that word rest might be more fitting. But let's jump in time and let's pick up the thread in Joshua. Let's go to Joshua 21. Joshua 21. We're going to pick it up in verse 43 and 44. And there are many companion scriptures. I just happen to pick one that's towards the end of Joshua's life here, because now this is years and years after they entered the promised land. So now, do they have rest? Joshua 21, verse 43. So the Lord gave to Israel all the land which he had sworn to give to their fathers. And they took possession of it and dwelt in it. Verse 44. The Lord gave them rest all around, according to all that he had sworn to their fathers, and not a man of all their enemies stood against them. The Lord delivered all the enemies into their hand. Now this is the part where I start to not get it. Is it just rest from war that God is talking about? Is that the rest here? In this case, not rest from physical activities, but rest from war? Because if so, it doesn't last very long, does it? We know that the Israelites never really pushed the nations out. They battled with them over and over. So to me, this is where this concept of rest starts to unravel a little bit. We have all these themes of what rest is, but it's not obvious, at least in the question that I posed at the beginning, what really is the point? Is it physical rest? Is it decreased activities? Is it peace from external enemies? Now, all of these pieces fit some of the scenarios, but the whole puzzle still seems like the pieces aren't linked together all that cohesively. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 3. Hebrews chapter 3. Now let's start to see if we can form some connection points here by heading back to Hebrews chapter 3 and 4. And in those chapters, the writer begins to pull together the underlying spiritual principle behind all of these physical examples. And then he links it to our own spiritual journey. Because there is something connected in how God rested on the seventh day in Genesis to the Israelites in the promised land, to the foretype rest in the millennium, and then the rest ultimately promised for all eternity in the kingdom. But what is that connection then? And what can we learn from it? And then finally, how does that change how we approach commanded rest days in our own lives? Hebrews chapter 3, we'll pick it up in verse 7. Hebrews 3, verse 7. It says, therefore, as the Holy Spirit says, today if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion and the day of trial in the wilderness, where your fathers tested me, tried me, and saw my works 40 years. Therefore, I was angry with that generation and said, they always go astray in their heart, and they have not known my ways. Verse 11. So I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Dropping down to verse 17, still in Hebrews 3. Now verse 17. Now with whom was he angry 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned, whose corpses fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who did not obey? And notice this next part, because this is where the threads start to intertwine. Verse 19. So we see that they could not enter in because of unbelief. Because of unbelief. They, the Israelites, that God rescued from slavery in Egypt, could not enter the promised land and therefore experience that promised rest. Why? Because of their unbelief. Now, you may be asking yourself, as I did, why would that stop them? I mean, their unbelief never stopped God from working with them before. I mean, God often had to drag them by their collars, many times in spite of themselves, to get them where they needed to be. And over again, from the plagues to the parting of the Red Sea, all the way to the door of the Promised Land, God did many signs and wonders to show them who he was, that he was their God. And time again, they didn't really get it or care to get it. So why now was that the issue? Did they just run out of chances? Was God finally at his breaking point there? And why would unbelief prevent them from entering into this rest? Again, what is the point being made here? If it was just physical rest exclusively, or protection from external enemies alone, that would have been simple. In fact, God was already doing that along the way in their journey. But this type of promised rest was something different. There was a physical component for sure, and God did give them some physical rest from their external enemies. That was a key part. But most importantly, it was spiritual in nature, as it deals with their relationship with God and the relationship he wanted to have with his people. The spiritual rest was to be able to enter into a relationship with God as God made his resting place with them. Does that sound familiar? It should. Rest as a place in a condition where a relationship can grow is very much an underlying theme throughout the Bible. It happened all the way back in Genesis on that seventh day. It happened with the Israelites in the tabernacle. It happened with the nation and the temple. It also happened with the Word as he became flesh and dwelt among men. Hold your place here in Hebrews, and let's turn back to Ephesians chapter 2. Ephesians chapter 2. We're going to pick it up in verse 19. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 19. It says, "Now therefore you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and the members of the household of God, having been built on the foundation of the prophets," or the apostles and the prophets, "Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building, being joined together, grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit." And of course, as we know, this will happen in the millennium as well. And certainly, we know that as Jesus Christ went to prepare a place for us, it will happen in God's kingdom forever. Now, though, if you don't have belief in God, you can't have that relationship. You can't be joined together in that rest because you don't want it. You're going to spend your time, your energy, and your effort in the wrong activities and neglect that spiritual relationship. Now, what was God trying to do with those Israelites? Now, God is a wonderful God. He blesses us far beyond what we deserve. He certainly blesses me far beyond what I deserve. And of course, he was fulfilling a promise to Abraham by giving his descendants this land. There's no doubt about that. But he wasn't just giving them the promised land as a little party favor and then backing away. The promised land was a blessing. It was a destination, but it wasn't the point. The point was the relationship that came when they got there. And frankly, gaining the promised land wasn't designed to be the end of the story. In so many ways, gaining the promised land was the start to a whole nother chapter in that relationship. And once they entered that land, that nation would be linked together with God in a most remarkable way. A special treasure, modeling a relationship with the Creator in a way never been conceived before. The original Israelites that left Egypt, they never got that. Or they never wanted that. Or maybe they never really believed in that relationship. The Israelites that came after them had pockets here and there that got it, but never consistently and completely. It's in this context that we finish up in Hebrews chapter 4. Hebrews chapter 4, we're going to jump ahead to verse 1 here. Hebrews 4, verse 1. It says, "Therefore," in the context of all those things, "therefore, since a promise remains of entering his rest, let us fear lest any of you seem to have come short of it. This is now shifting ahead to the future. This is now talking about our relationship, a new covenant relationship with God. Verse 2, for indeed the gospel was preached to us as well as to them. But the word which they heard didn't profit them, not being mixed with faith in those who heard it. They didn't believe it. They didn't want it. Verse 3, for we who have believed do enter that rest. As he has said, so I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest, although the works were finished from the foundation of the world. For he has spoken in a certain place of the seventh day in this way. For God rested on the seventh day from all his works. And again, in this place, they shall not enter my rest. Certainly, they did not enter that full spiritual rest that involves a committed relationship with the creator of the universe. Maybe they and others could have still have received some of the physical applications of rest. They did have periods of peace, that's for sure, and they did have physical rest on the Sabbath, but as we know, the physical is there to illustrate the spiritual. The physical was never the end goal. It was the spiritual part. Dropping down to verse 8, still in Hebrews 4. For if Joshua had given them rest, which he couldn't, for if Joshua had given them rest, then he would not afterward have spoken of another day. Now, Joshua could have enforced physical rest. He could have made laws and enforced them that they don't lift anything on the Sabbath if he wanted to. The spiritual rest, though, is from a relationship with God, and that is entirely different. Now, I want to pause just for a moment and come at this from maybe a little bit different of a perspective. And I want to use an analogy. I wish I was smart enough to say that I came up with this all by myself, but I certainly did not. This is from an individual named John Walton. I don't know if you've heard that name before, but super smart. He's one of the more prominent Old Testament scholars living today. And if you have a cultural study Bible, oftentimes he'll be in there as either the primary or one of the contributing authors. And his specialty is making connections between the written text of the Bible and the cultural understanding of the audience for which it was written to. So it goes without saying that the Bible, which is timeless, has things that are written not for our time. The principles are timeless, but it was written in a different language to a different audience for a specific purpose. And as we become further removed from that culture, some of those connection points that the writer is making in the Bible can be harder to understand. So imagine if a poor archaeologist 300 years in the future came across a text message where I said, I don't want to go to work today, but I'm just going to bite the bullet. Well, it would say, like, Mike's a programmer. He's not that dangerous line of work. I don't think he's getting shot at, and why would he bite a bullet anyway? So, of course, we understand that that is a cultural idiom. So John Walton, in his book, The Lost World of Adam and Eve, makes the case that the Genesis account, which we often call that creation account, likely hit the original audience in a slightly different way. And modern people, we often look at Genesis and we try to make claims of its scientific authenticity or try to take pieces of it out and look at it from a scientific perspective. But Walton argues that no one originally was thinking about the literal material construction. Like God took two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom and he made water. Like no one at that time was looking at that. However, the bigger perspective is how God ordered the known universe, how he divided chaos into the functioning ordered system. And God then, through his 6 days, organized and set into motion the proper place and the proper function of his creation. Whereas the material origin, like the physical makeups, was secondary to that purpose. And Walton uses the analogy of a house. If you first move into a house, all of the physical components are there. You've got walls, you've got a roof, hopefully you have a plumbing system, electrical, all that is in there. But it doesn't become a home until you organize it, set your furniture in it, and then begin to use it as it's designed. A place with just some walls and a floor doesn't become a dining room until you put a table in it, and you start to eat there, and you start to gather there. It doesn't become a living room until the family gathers there. Maybe play some games there, perhaps sit in front of a fireplace. It becomes that specific room as you designate it and assign it purpose. And then you start to use it in that purpose. And if we expand that analogy, when you first purchase a property, you might have a house. It might be filled with boxes, but it's not organized, it's chaotic. Everything is not where it needs to be. But once you get it all squared away and you start using it as designed, then it switches from a house into your home. You have created a home out of a house when it begins to function as you design. That's why a lot of people, when they're on vacations, never feel really like they're at home. Now, they have all the physical things that they need there. It may be a really relaxing place, maybe super lovely, but it's not really set up and organized and functioning in a way that makes it feel like your resting place, the place where you feel most at home. And Walton again makes the case that in the creation account, God puts everything together so that that relationship can happen. It's not that God is so tired after 6 days of creating that he just has to take the seventh day off, but rather the seventh day is the reason for the first 6 days. It's the culmination of why God did all of that creating so that he could now then have a relationship with that creation. And this happens so many times throughout the Bible. God brings his people out of Egypt and is ready to plant them in the promised land. In the millennium, there will be peace, everyone under their vine and fig tree. In all those cases, God is offering to make his dwelling place, his resting place with the people for the relationship. He puts all of these pieces in place. He organizes it. He divides the order from the chaos. But it's not so that the Israelites can sleep once they cross the Jordan. It's not so that the Israelites can just take another day off. It's so that the people don't have to spin their wheels and break out of the trap of futile pursuits and can experience rest in a relationship with God. God gets everything ready, but the people still have to choose. And that's why those concepts are so interlinked together. The rest in those cases is not just to save energy, it's to redirect that energy towards something completely different, to shift away from the physical and devote time to the spiritual, to leave the other cares and desires and the priorities and your work, and to then have rest with God. Verse 9, still in Hebrews 4. Verse 9 now. There remains, therefore, a rest for the people of God. That's you and me. Verse 10. For he who has entered his rest has himself also ceased from his works as God did from his. Now, if we're seeking to enter that spiritual rest, we do that when we take our time, our energy, and our effort, the culmination of our work, and redirect it towards that relationship with God. Just as God, after he put the creation in order, functioning as designed, stopped that work to have a relationship with his creation. Finally, verse 11, Hebrews 4, verse 11, let us therefore, with all that context, let us therefore be diligent to enter that rest, lest anyone fall according to the same example of disobedience. Well then, do you believe? Do you desire it? Do you want to commit to that relationship? Hopefully we start to see how little it has to do with physical rest and how much it has to do with spiritual commitment. And the writer in Hebrews goes on to hammer home this point. Continued on in the chapter, we have the word of God. We have a high priest that can understand our struggles. We have all of these tools so that we can boldly go before God and strive towards that relationship as he makes his dwelling place with us. When we think about what rest means in that context and the reason behind those rest periods, some of the things that Jesus Christ had against the Pharisees starts to hit just a little differently. Let's notice an example in Matthew chapter 12. Matthew chapter 12. Now, we might start to see a slightly different side to these scriptures now. Matthew chapter 12, we'll pick it up in verse 1. Matthew chapter 12, verse 1 now. It says, at that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples were hungry, and they began to pluck heads of grain and eat it. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath. Now, this is one example of many that we could pick from. And I'm sure we all remember the tension between the Pharisees and Jesus Christ. The Pharisees were very strict, especially on what you could or could not do on the Sabbath. And that would very much include like how much you can carry, how far you can carry it, all sorts of restrictions on physical activity, because that was their overriding concern. But as we've talked about, the physical part of rest, while it is important, is not the most central principle behind these commandments. And Jesus Christ repeatedly demonstrates the errancy of that thinking. And he often did that by doing physical activity, by working, so to speak. Dropping down to verse 10. And behold, there was a man who had a withered hand. Then they asked him, saying, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? That they might accuse him. Then he said to them, what man is there among you who has one sheep, and if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will not lay hold of it and lift it out? Oh, of how much more value then is man than sheep? Therefore, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. And he said to the man, stretch out your hand. And he stretched it out, and it was restored as whole as the other. Verse 14, which always seems so out of place to me. And then the Pharisees went out and plotted against him, how they might destroy him. Well, that was not the right answer for the Pharisees. Now, you might think, well, what would they have against healing? Surely they would have made some exception when it comes to healing, right? I mean, it's not like Jesus Christ went and did a 12-hour surgery or something here. But if you're only looking at rest in terms of limiting physical activity, well, then when you see physical activity, you think it's wrong, and you have to limit it in order to be resting. But that's not exclusively the rest Jesus Christ is talking about. If we back it up one chapter to verse chapter 11, we get verse 28, very familiar verse. Matthew 11, verse 28. Jesus Christ says, come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. That's not physical. That's not strictly mental or emotional either, although those are certainly absolutely linked and involved, of course. But it's primarily spiritual. Jesus Christ isn't going to rock them gently to sleep. He wants a connected relationship that satisfies the soul, and when ultimately realized, fulfills the reason why God created us. So what does that mean for us personally? What can we do in our day-to-day lives to bring us closer to those goals? Well, the most important is belief. That was mentioned in Hebrews earlier as one of the core reasons why the Israelites just couldn't get on the right track. Now, I don't think that that meant that the Israelites didn't believe that God existed, but they definitely did struggle in believing that God was their God and the only God, and that God did want to have a special relationship with them. And for us, we also need to continually call to mind our belief in God, not just that he exists, but what he has promised us and that unique relationship that he wants to have with us. Let's notice John 14, John chapter 14. We'll start in verse 1 of John chapter 14. It says, let not your heart be troubled, verse 1. You believe in God. Believe also in me. Verse 2 of John 14. In my Father's house are many mansions. And if it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you and for me. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. We all want to take up residence in that mansion. We believe that God will fulfill and deliver on that promise, and that ultimately we will join him into the family of God. Dropping down to verse 22, still in John 14, now verse 22. Judas, not Iscariot, said to him, Lord, how is it that you will manifest yourself to us and not to the world? Verse 23. And Jesus answered and said to him, if anyone loves me, and that's us here, right? If anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our home with him, our resting place with him. This we believe, and we keep in the forefront of our minds as the vision of the future to come. Now, there's more, of course, too. Of course, we're here on the Sabbath, a commanded rest day, and absolutely, we understand that we are to abide by the physical part of this commandment. We don't continue in our professions this day. This isn't the day to go out and chop firewood for hours and hours. We certainly do limit our physical activities on this day. But if we are just replacing it by sleeping in longer or taking naps all day, well, then it wasn't a net gain at all. In order for us to really utilize these periods of rest, we have to redirect our time to a spiritual relationship. Now, I want to notice two verses in Isaiah 58. Isaiah 58. Isaiah 58, this is a famous chapter because it puts more clarity on the two physical things that we often do. It highlights the spiritual rationale behind each one of them. One of them is fasting, and then where it applies to us today, verses 13 and 14, is talking about the Sabbath. Isaiah 58, verse 13, it says, if you turn away your foot from the Sabbath, from doing your pleasure on my holy day, that's not just talking about work or your profession. And call the Sabbath a delight, the holy day of the Lord honorable, and shall honor him, not by doing your own ways, nor finding your own pleasure, nor speaking your own words. Then you shall delight yourself in the Lord. That is the rest that we're talking about. And I will cause you to ride on the high hills of earth and feed you with the heritage of Jacob, your father. The mouth of the Lord has spoken. In other words, when you transform from your own activities to focusing on that relationship with God, then, and only then, are you maximizing your resting opportunities. And finally, we can also use the example of Jesus Christ to do good on these rest periods, to do good. And these are certainly periods of active rest, so to speak. Far from trying to eliminate all physical activity, you will instead be doing different activity. Studying, praying, appreciating his creation are all key parts, but also having fellowship with his spiritual family, helping others in need, writing cards and letters of encouragement, visiting others that are in need, you name it. Lots of things that you can do to bring joy, ease pain and suffering, and provide comfort during periods of rest. Well, in conclusion, if we revisit our house analogy against the backdrop of where we started today, for 6 days, God organized the house. He set everything in its place. He separated the chaos from the boxes. He organized the rooms by their desired use. And at the end of the 6th day, the house was now a home, and it was ready to be utilized in the way that it was designed and intended. And when day 7 came about, it was time to actually use that home as it was planned from the beginning, to now have a relationship with human beings, to walk among them. When God rested and was refreshed, he was actively participating in a long-awaited relationship with potential sons and daughters. He created the Sabbath for man, so that man can rest in him and focus on that relationship. When God led his people out of Egypt and he took them to the promised land, it was for a purpose. As it says in Leviticus 26, verse 12, I'll just quote it. It says, I will walk among you and be your God, and you shall be my people. Again, pointing to that relationship. And then all the way at the very end, Revelation chapter 21 and verse 3, the final fulfillment of God's resting place, Revelation 21, 3, it says, I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. The relationship, the fulfillment of this rest will finally be complete. Right now, God has given us blessings. He's given us protections. He's given us a congregation we can attend, a Bible we can read, and so much more. God has put all the pieces in place so that we can take advantage of that relationship, to make sure that we capitalize on it. This Sabbath, while one example of a period of rest, is a wonderful tool designed to point us in the right direction. And we have that each and every week. Rest is far from simply decreasing your physical activities. The rest God has in mind redirects and engages our strength, not in the physical, but in the spiritual, and to actively connect in a relationship that will long outlast anything physical. So, brethren, as we think about rest, don't let yourself drift off to sleep, but rather actively participate to the fullest in that relationship with God.